Ingram Smith, Bud Elliott, back again for another episode of the Nolcast. Bud, certainly not an evening where we are short on topics. Got a lot of things to do, a lot of things to talk about. Honestly, this will be a challenge to have any kind of respectable time on this audio file. Could be pretty easy to sit here and probably talk for 2.5 hours or so, but we will attempt to avoid that. Go ahead and get into the meat of the conversation, of which there's many aspects to touch on. Before we get into that, I do want to thank our sponsor, Louisiana Hot Sauce, that makes this possible. Want to thank all of you for the feedback that you've given us on social media. Bud and I are incredibly fortunate to be able to be paired with a product that we both honestly love and enjoy and are excited to talk about further. And there really is would be tough to find a better pairing of sponsor, really pairing of two sponsors that we have. But would just like to thank them for what they do to make this possible and ask that you continue to engage with us and them on social media. So, Bud, with that being said, let's talk about a Saturday afternoon that poses a lot of questions, and we'll do our best to answer as many possible, at least as many that are possible to answer in a responsible way.
Yeah, Ingram, didn't really expect to be talking about 63-20. I don't know about you, but that was a little bit surprising to me. And by that, I mean, that was pretty shocking. And I think folks inside the program were similarly shocked. A loss would not have been surprising, but a loss by that margin really raises some greater questions than just should they play a different right tackle or are the right combination of guys being used in the secondary. It kind of poses some questions about the core of the program and whether they're doing things the right way, whether the coaches are truly getting the buy-in from the players. I think that's maybe a little bit too macro to go after one loss. So if they lose another ball game, we'll certainly have more of that conversation. But ultimately, where do you want to start? Do you want to start with offense or defense? Because they were both terrible. I guess defense was record-settingly bad, so we could start there.
Yeah, that is the problem. There's a lot of things on either side of the ball. There's just a lot of kind of issues and ideas that are floating around the program that we could spend 45 minutes talking before we ever addressed a single position group or a single area of ball that we thought was particularly deficient on Saturday. But why don't we go ahead, have the conversation about the defense, and we'll kind of finish up with a look back at the offensive side of the ball as well.
Can you give me a D?
No.
Okay. Yeah, me neither. That was I'll give
none
you a
to
D
be found.
For disaster. Atrocious defense. I mean, some of the worst defense we've ever seen at Florida State. They've given up 105 points now in 3 games. I believe you have to go back to 1984 to find the last time a Florida State defense gave up that many points in a 3-year span to open the season. And I struggle to understand exactly how this happened, because I don't think Florida State's coaches are dumb, but there's no doubt in my mind that they are not getting through to the players. And that should be obvious on the field. The number of missed assignments they had, they probably had a critical missed assignment on more than half of Louisville's offensive plays. And I'm talking not just guy be a little bit out of position, but being grossly misaligned, not knowing his role, not doing the right thing, not taking the right steps, the right footwork, not keying the right thing, not looking at the right thing, not playing the right coverage, like acting like you're in zone when you're supposed to be in man and the rest of the defense is in man. Person over the slot, that's primarily the major violator there. That was so bad. And I really, just from talking to people, they didn't look that bad at practice. That's from people I trust. And so I do believe Florida State's coaches were legitimately shell-shocked at how bad they looked. Now, the question is, should they have been that shell-shocked? Should they have realized that some players simply weren't getting it? I know we've talked to sources who know some of these players from their days as recruits and coming up and parents and whatnot. Some of these kids have expressed that they are really not getting it and that maybe the defense is too complicated or that this defensive staff is unable to teach it. Either way, it's unacceptable and you have to make changes. I think what they're going to do is dumb it down and play fewer coverages, have fewer checks, have fewer adjustments, get the call in quicker, and just let these kids get lined up and play ball more. Now, that's not a perfect solution because the really good offenses you play will probably realize what you're doing because you have to dumb it down, which makes you more predictable. However, it's much preferable to what they've been doing right now, which is just not giving their superior athletes a chance to even be in the picture frame, right? There were numerous instances where a guy was open by 10 or 15 yards against this defense. I don't care how good of an athlete you are. You can't use that athleticism if the opponent is that wide open. Additionally, I feel like you can almost see these guys thinking on the field instead of reacting. They have not internalized their defensive assignments well enough, perhaps because it's too complicated. Perhaps they're not putting the work in. Perhaps the staff is not getting through to them. Maybe they're trying to put too much on them. Whatever it is, you have some extremely athletic players out there who actually look very unathletic. They look slow because they're playing flat-footed. They're thinking too much as opposed to reacting, triggering, and attacking. That's no way to play defense. And if this doesn't improve, they're going to need to have a new defensive staff next year. I can completely understand keeping this group around after 2014. In 2014, you had a number of players who was very clear, had one foot out the door to the NFL. You dealt with some injuries. And it was that whole team just didn't really have great buy-in and great motivation because they had already won a national title. And if you had gotten rid of this defensive staff after 2014, a season in which you went to the college football playoff, you went undefeated in the regular season. Yes, you got drubbed by Oregon, but part of that was also the fact that the offense turned the ball over five times. That would have looked really bad, and it would have looked bad for recruiting. You would have had four defensive coordinators in 4 years. Last year, Charles Kelly's unit was a top 10 unit by pretty much all accounts. Really made nice strides, far fewer big plays allowed. But this is kind of the rubber match year, right? You've had one bad underachieving year and 1 year where the defense played to its talent level. This is the year that's going to show the fan base and show Jimbo Fisher, Charles Kelly and his staff can get this defense to play to his talent level consistently, or more often than not, it will underachieve. So far, it looks like it's going to underachieve.
Really, you almost render your talent level null and void when you don't understand the responsibilities that are being asked of you or what the system or the scheme dictates as to what you're responsible and what you need to do on any particular play. But at the end of the podcast last week, we talked about a couple different areas that we were going to look for. One thing I mentioned was the secondary's propensity to just cover no one. Really, I should say the defense's propensity because it's not always a back four issue. But fourth play of the game, no one, you just referenced, it's one of those plays, no one's within 15 or 20 yards of the wide receiver. Jackson just happens to miss him. There's a systematic failing on the defensive side of the ball right now to have the players understand what their responsibility is, like what they're asked to do in particular situations. If an offense puts somebody in motion, it seems like we blow our responsibility 25% of the times. If the offense stacks wide receivers, I'd push that number up to 40 or 45%. There's just too many situations where there's very little understanding, and it forces an offense to not earn anything. I mean, you know, you're too many 35-yard plays because, you know, either a wide receiver's not covered, a man who blitzes lets somebody cross his face and out into the flat. There's just too many easy plays being given up that really render the talent of the defense not all that important.
Just non-competitive, uncontested plays, way too many of them. And look, it should absolutely be noted that Florida State has played one of the toughest schedules to open the season of anybody. As far as offenses go, Florida State played better defensively than Alabama did against Ole Miss. All right. I mean, Ole Miss just put up 40 on the Tide and a far higher yards per play. I think they were like 7.25 yards per play against the Tide, which is huge. At the same time, though, 63 points is just unacceptable at any level for a team that has this much talent. And like you said, there's just way too many busts in coverage. Unless you believe that these players are just absolutely stupid, and I don't, that falls primarily on coaching.
Honestly, I don't care if they're stupid. I mean, if they're stupid, then you know your players are stupid and you have to give them a scheme. Like, there's, and I know what you're saying, I don't mean to derail your point, but the intelligence level of the player, that's the products you have. That's the, you know, those are the groceries that you have to use the recipe. You've got to work with what you have. And there's, if the players are dumb, then you are creating a system where they don't understand what's being asked of them.
Right. It all comes down to you have to evaluate the learning capacity and retention capacity of your players and then apply however much scheme you can fit into their understanding that allows them to still play fast. And right now, it's very clear they've been overloaded. So they're going to have to dial this back. It does not mean you play only man coverage. This is not 1960. That will not work. Everybody on the schedule will eat you up if that happens. But maybe you have fewer checks. Maybe you have fewer coverage rules. Maybe you're a little bit more conservative on the back end on some of the stuff you're doing. I know everybody believes that the solution is always just to become hyper-aggressive. I don't think that's necessarily a great idea right now. Specifically, after rewatching it, the biggest problem areas, in my opinion, were linebacker and essentially the interior of the back seven. So your linebackers, your star position, which is your nickel, and then your safeties. The linebackers, the main issue that I saw was just complete lack of responsibility play, right? Just not reading your keys, not playing within the context of the scheme at all, being slow to trigger, not taking on blocks with the correct shoulder, not working in conjunction with the defensive ends, especially on some of the veer and read option looks. That was just terrible. There is no way Florida State's linebacker should ever play that poorly. And they played so slow, it really made me think, what is being taught by Bill Miller and that defensive staff, the linebackers coach? That's awful. Marcus Lewis, several times, Jimbo Fisher, I believe, in interviews today, referenced that at times there were players who were supposed to be playing man coverage but got caught looking into the backfield as if they were in zone coverage. I believe that on at least one or two occasions, that player was Marcus Lewis, who got repeatedly picked on by Louisville. Look, Louisville did a tremendous job to use Lamar Jackson's legs to occupy the mind of the defense. That allowed the running back to have a really nice day for them. But it also allowed very large passing lanes for Jackson, and he took advantage of those quite nicely. I also thought the safeties were a little bit too timid. They didn't come down and help out quickly enough once they identified run. They also didn't take very good angles. When they were supposed to spill, they didn't. When they were supposed to force, they didn't. They didn't run the alley very well. It just was not a great day for that defense, to say the least.
You mentioned a couple of things I just want to touch on, Bud. You mentioned at the beginning that there's plays where you can, like, almost literally see the defenders trying to read what's going on and as such not reactive to what's around them. I would say that you can go back and watch Louisville's first touchdown. Matthew Thomas is literally sitting there in a position to make the play and is scanning it. You can watch his eyes scan to three different places on the field trying to find the ball, trying to either play his responsibility or play the ball. A couple of weeks ago, I talked, and we were talking about Matthew Thomas at the time, but I talked about there's no greater way to have like a 4-5 linebacker turned into a 4-8 linebacker than a guy that doesn't know his responsibility on the field or kind of second guesses himself. Thomas is certainly guilty of that at times. I don't think there's a greater example of this than Marshall, one of the faster players on the field. Consistently looks slow on game day because I don't think he either trusts himself or understands what's being asked of him in the scheme. You don't have to, like, make these great leaps to see so many different examples of players that are thinking and just aren't out there playing, aren't out there reacting. It's a group that has no instinctual play and is turning in historically poor results as a byproduct of it.
Absolutely, man. Just so many blown assignments, and that's not even to mention the front, which I didn't think played all that well in Joshua's absence. The Walker played pretty well. They did a nice job on Jacob Pugh at times, and I felt like the interior of the defensive line did not play well enough to make their plan work, which I think their plan was essentially to let the interior of the defensive line beat blocks and take the handoff and make sure that any time Jackson took the ball, he was punished. And, of course, none of that worked at all. In theory, their plan made a lot of sense, but the mastery of the plan was far lacking. And so I think the next thing we need to talk about, how much can this defense improve immediately? Because they have a really difficult schedule coming up, and they will need to improve, like, right away. USF, their opponent this weekend, runs a very similar offense at times to what you're going to see from Louisville and what you'll see from Ole Miss in terms of some of the zone read and the read option stuff. They have a very athletic quarterback. Now, he's not a very good passer. He's very erratic. But ultimately, even the really erratic guys can hit players who are wide open. So I think what you're going to see is sort of a, I don't want to say back to basics approach, but they are going to really sort of reset the building blocks in some ways and say, okay, can the defense execute this simple concept over and over? Okay, has everybody got this? Cool. Then we're going to move on to this. Has everybody got this? What parts of this are y'all not comfortable with? And if there's any part they're not comfortable with, we're going to throw it out of the playbook if you're the coaching staff. That's got to be it right now because there's clearly been an overload. And what do you do if there's an overload? You got to take some stuff off the plate. You got to really hone in and focus on the stuff that you can give them confidence executing. And I believe this is something the staff is very concerned with this week. I do not think they want to be highly negative and critical of these guys. In fact, I was told that in the postgame speech, Fisher told the team that the coaches didn't get them prepared enough. That's Jimbo Fisher and his staff taking ownership, which I think is a good sign. Following through on that statement means instead of really yelling at the players and being super intense at them, which I know that there's, of course, always going to be some yelling, you have got to make sure these guys, you got to rebuild their confidence, especially in the back seven, and let them play fast and let them play with their ability. Right now, it's very clear their confidence is shaken, and that's got to be improved.
Undoubtedly, certainly an agreement there. I don't want to pick on, like, individual players, but I would say I would point people in the direction of your quarterly reviews, the play-by-play breakdowns that you guys do over at Tomahawk. It's fantastic read. It's as unique as content as you're going to find out there. And, I would just say this. Marcus Lewis, you've got to – that is one individual who has to have a much better justification for the playing time that he's getting. That's an individual that's responsible for a lot of things, or at least it would appear that way. And of any particular personnel changes that you might see, I certainly agree with what you're going to do from a macro perspective about – making things more concise, making sure people have a complete understanding or otherwise it's not present in what's being asked of them. Lewis is one person in particular that I would I'll just watch and see what type of snaps he gets. And in my opinion, if there's one particular personnel move, that might be it.
I definitely agree with you there. Now, look, I'm still high on Marcus Lewis. He has got to play better assignment football and more within the context of the defensive scheme. Sometimes it looks like he was badly misaligned. Other times, I'm not so sure. Other times, there may have been other guys who were supposed to be offering support to the inside. I don't know who you put in there if it's not Marcus Lewis. I mean, maybe it's Levante Taylor, but I'm not so sure about that. I know that the staff is very high on Kyle Myers, by the way, a player who I was not sure how quickly he was going to pick up the defense. they have some options. Ultimately, I don't think Lewis is going to lose his spot until he's given the opportunity to play within a more simplified defense, which is what I think they're going to go to. Now, a simplified defense will have some frustrations for fans, but I do think it could lead to fewer just enormous busts. And that's the real thing you have to avoid. When you have Florida State's talent and athleticism and length, the worst thing you can do is run some sort of scheme where the players are so confused and hesitant that they're not able to use that athleticism and length to their advantage. That's a bad thing. They've got to simplify this. If they don't, then I think there's going to have to be some changes next year.
Anything else you want to remark as far as what we saw on the defensive side of the ball? I mean, look, it's 63 points, 56 of which the defense was responsible. Not going to tack that punt return, and certainly you could probably break it down more, and there's responsibility of the offense. There's another horribly covered kick. But that was a pathetic performance, historically bad. And you're right. Nice contract with guaranteed money. Be damned if this is the performance that you keep getting out of your defense. I don't see a way in which Charles Kelly will be able to return. And then there's certainly other people on the staff whose jobs would be looked at. You've played 8 quarters of meaningful football so far, and 6 of them have been a disaster on the defensive side of the ball. So I don't want to go overboard with it. Don't want to lose people in details, but I didn't think we could start this conversation anywhere other than addressing what we saw from the defense on Saturday.
Yeah, I think there are 2 other things. This is a defense whose players routinely over the summer made some really, really kind of cocky style comments, right? I know several of them talked about how this could be the best Florida State defense ever, when in fact so far it's been the worst in 30 years. I do believe there's a certain level of humility required to play within a defensive scheme. And this could be a humbling loss that helps these guys get back to basics and realize how important it is to play within the scheme. And that's independent of the understanding of the scheme. Clearly, if you don't understand it, you cannot play within it. But once they get the understanding of it, cutting down on some of the freelancing and making sure they get lined up and more attention to detail is a big-time deal. The other thing I think that might help as well, and if you're going to a little bit more simplified defense, this could help too, is to get the play calling quicker, to give guys more time to line up and to give them more time to look at it and to have hopefully somebody on the defense say, hold on a second, our defensive alignment on this doesn't make any sense. We need to bump out so that we're not out-leveraged to the field, right? Because the way that the defense is currently aligned is giving great blocking angles to this opposing offense, allowing inferior players to block our supreme athletes in an advantageous way.
Yeah, that would be great if it happened. I mean, that's been an issue for more than a year now, though. I mean, we have a real problem with tempo in general, but we have, even sometimes when tempo is not even present, we have a real hard time just getting ready, getting set, and having a firm understanding of what's being asked just at the fundamental idea of what's being asked of our own individual responsibility on defense. So I think that would be a great step to take, but that's not the first time that this, you didn't have to lose by 63 for that to be an issue. So I'm somewhat skeptical as to how much that can and will be addressed.
Yeah, and I think that Florida State's biggest problem with tempo is that it doesn't use it on offense. And I think FSU's lack of tempo on offense makes people think that it has this huge problem with tempo on defense. And I really don't think the numbers support that. A lot of teams struggle with tempo because tempo is a great weapon and everybody should use it to some varying degree on offense. That Florida State doesn't is it an issue of its offense, but I think it also makes us, as we observe the program, think, oh man, we don't adjust to tempo well. You think opposing defenses would adjust to Florida State well if Florida State used tempo on offense? No, I don't think so, but they have a control freak of a head coach / offensive coordinator who his belief is apparently that his input on the offense is worth more than catching a defense off guard.
Yeah, that's probably not going to change, so perhaps the situation surrounding how Florida State handles tempo will continue to be an issue. It's somewhat similar to what we talked about last week with Mark Ennis as far as some of the challenges that Georgia Tech's defense faces because of what they see at practice and just the Baylors and some of the other various offenses in the country and what the ramifications of the own offense that you run on your own defense just as a byproduct of what it sees and what it consumes every day at practice.
Oh, sure. I'm not suggesting Florida State go Baylor tempo. And to be honest, Louisville didn't really hurt Florida State with tempo. They didn't run that fast of a thing. They just totally out-executed Florida State and confused the crap out of Florida State. It was a pretty big beatdown.
Oh, it was a damn big beatdown. Yeah, no debate about that. A beatdown that was only moderately made more aesthetically pleasing by some rather curious decisions as far as decision-making and going for a field goal at the end of the game. The offense bears a ton of responsibility in this, and maybe the problems on offense, Bud, not that this has been a real happy, positive podcast so far, but maybe the problems that are present on offense are even of a little bit more disturbing level, at least for me they are. I'm curious as to your opinion.
Anger, before we pivot topics here, I want to tell you about another key member of our team, Madison Social, the best spot in Tallahassee for food and drink. They've been with us now for 2 years. Really appreciate them sponsoring us again. From what I heard last week, even though Florida State was getting its butt kicked, the beer was still cold, the sights were still really nice, food was still great, and after Florida State got done playing, if you were sober enough, you could continue to watch other games there on their high-def screens and maybe some actual quality football. Maybe see Nick Saban almost have a little heart attack on the sideline with Chad Kelly throwing his bombs against them late. That was pretty sweet. All would look really good in Madison Social HD. Hopefully this weekend you can go to Madison Social and watch Florida State get a win while enjoying a cold beverage. They are very much aware of how much noon games suck. They have t-shirts to that effect, and you can get one of those, but you can also be rest assured that they open early on Saturdays for noon games and that they try to make this experience as good as possible for everybody. For all of our Tallahassee listeners, definitely go check out Madison Social on game day, but not just for home games, but also for road games.
Yeah, get yourself a Nullcast Bloody Mary, please. Support the show, support Madison Social. Like you said, win or lose, that is a great place to watch a game. And would have a whole hell of a lot of more positive breakdown to comment on Madison Social than either the offensive side or the defensive side of the ball tonight.
Yes, the execution by Matt and his team there that run Madison Social and that restaurant group, much better than either Florida State's offense or defense. They, it's a lot better. Hopefully FSU will match them pretty soon. Yeah, I think that the problems on defense are more immediately the concern and probably easier to fix. The problems on offense are, I think, more multiple and maybe more concerning in the long term. And part of this is I do believe it's easier to coach defense if you have elite-level talent. It's very hard to coach defense if you don't. But if you do, good coaching should be able to produce good results more consistently, I think, than offense. And that's because defense, and we've said this before, it's sort of a collective individual endeavor where offense is truly more of a team game. But the offense, there are pretty serious questions at every offensive position right now.
Well, there's serious problems, there's serious questions along the offense. And it's a lot of the problems, a lot of the accusations that people are so quick to make about the defense and Kelly's system, you don't have the exact mirrored situations on offenses. It's kind of impossible, but you have blown assignments. You have a offensive line that's underperforming significantly. You have wide receivers that are blowing assignments. So you have two wide receivers blocking one guy. You have wide receivers who are just having not as historically bad day as the defense, but that was an incredibly poor effort turned in by pretty much every unit on the offensive side of the ball. And it really brings into question how much Jimbo Fisher's offense of what he wants to do, the variants that exist in it, topics that we've talked about for a long time. And another one will be Jimbo Fisher's reluctance to accept a situation and an issue in college football that you almost have to, and that is you've got to give up this idea that you're somehow not playing like real respectable offense to adapt some of these modern ideas in the game. And in particular, use your quarterback as a weapon, use your quarterback's feet as a weapon. Bud, why don't we go ahead and lead the conversation with if watching that offense and then going home at night, theoretically, or turning on a game Sunday morning that you DVR'd and watching your mentor run the hell out of his quarterback when he has to, if that's not an experience that would not somewhat have Jimbo Fisher change his theory, or at least be open to change and adaptation of some of the modern ideas of ball, I'm not sure when you would expect to see it out of Fisher otherwise.
Absolutely right. If not now, when? I think Jimbo Fisher is a fantastic quarterback coach. I think he's a really smart offensive mind, but I do believe that he thinks some of these tactics are sort of beneath him. Like they're too kind of cheap and high school-y or college-y for his pristine, pure offense. And ultimately, he shouldn't care about that. He should care about winning football games at the college level. His offense had 10 points before Louisville pulled its starters. That's pathetic in 2016 college football when you recruit athletes like Florida State does. People are scoring points everywhere. Offenses just don't struggle like this. And it's really concerning to see. Nick Saban allowed his quarterback to run 18 times Saturday. 18 carries for that kid. 38 carries for Jalen Hurts through three games where he hasn't even been the full-time starter yet. Think about that. Bobby Petrino, an offensive mind who I have to believe Fisher respects immensely, having coached in the SEC at the same time Petrino was, and seeing all the great stuff that he has done with pro-style offenses in his coaching career, is now running the crap out of his quarterback. Every play involves some sort of major quarterback run threat. And yet here's Jimbo Fisher's offense, dropping back, not using play action effectively, not really truly threatening the defense and making the defense care about the quarterback's legs. It does seem, and I don't want to use the term antiquated, but it does seem like Jimbo Fisher is not getting the most out of this offensive talent. I don't think he's getting close to the most out of this offensive talent. I think some of these receivers that are playing are playing because they know the offense the best. But the question is your offense the best way to get the most out of this talent, or is changing it up a little bit to use some of the more superior athletes like you would think would happen at other programs like Ohio State's doing, like better coach than Jimbo Fisher, like Nick Saban's doing, better coach than Jimbo Fisher. They're getting more out of their athletes, it seems, early on in their careers. And Florida State is stuck with this very rigid system that when it works, it's beautiful. It's amazing. But you're not going to have Jameis Winston every year. And I don't understand how Florida State, all week we heard from our sources that they thought they were going to run DeAndre Francois a lot more. And we both thought, good, he needs it. He's not near the passer that people think he is yet. That'll help occupy the defense's mind. That'll help simplify some coverages. That'll help open some more things up for the pass game. Where was it? He needs to run DeAndre Francois earlier in the game and stop with this Puritan offense stuff. This is just too... It is frustrating. I think fans out there have got to be incredibly frustrated seeing all these teams across college football score points on points on points, and Jimbo Fisher's offense has to kick a pathetic field goal when they're at 63-17, is it, to get to 63-20. And I personally think the reason why Jimbo Fisher did it is to avoid criticism for his offense. Because if you go up there and score 17, people are like, hey, you couldn't even score 20 points. At least 20 looks a little bit better and helps shift the blame from his offense to the defense. I personally think that's why he did it, to avoid media criticism.
Yeah, it was obviously an aesthetic motivation. For whatever the particular inner motivation, I'm not sure. But you know, that's nothing else than to make the final scoreline look that much, you know, that much more respectable, if such a thing was possible. But you're right. what up? 160 yards before Louisville starts putting in second and third stringers.
Pretty pathetic.
In total offense.
I mean,
pathetic play from the offense, and horrible all around. Really saw the downside, or at least some of the worst case scenarios that are associated with having a redshirt freshman in general, particularly a redshirt freshman making his first start on the road. Bud, you touched on it briefly there, but why don't we go ahead and spend 2-3 minutes just giving an idea as to what we saw from Francois in particular.
Yeah, look, Anger, we did a good job relative to some of the other sites, I think, of pumping the brakes a little bit on Francois. Say, look, he did some really good things. However, he's also getting away with some things that are not good and that are going to catch up with him. Ultimately, he only threw one pick in this game, I believe, but at times that's going to catch up with him. The late throws, not anticipating on throws, not always having the best touch on throws. I'm worried now a little bit that because the offensive line and the other pass protectors, like your running back, number four, doesn't seem willing to pass block at all.
We'll get there. That's coming.
Yeah. And also some of the tight ends who actually have really done a poor job chipping at times. I think I'm worried that Francois is going to start seeing ghosts and vacate clean pockets because he did it a couple times on Saturday. Now
he did it a couple times against Ole Miss too.
It's a freshman
first time
man.
Start.
It's right. Yeah, exactly. It's a freshman. It's his first time on the road. I get it. I'm not super worried about it, but I don't want that to become a habit for him. Obviously,
he's taking some shots. I mean, taking some straight, you know, look, you can't complain about officiating in a game like that, but he sure takes some shots that sometimes get targeting calls in other games that I've watched, and way too frequently there's just a guy who's making a clean run to the quarterback who is able to just knock the hell out of your quarterback as he's releasing the ball. Took some shots, some major big shots in the first quarter just by both your right guard, right tackle, unable to block in certain pass situations and giving guys just free run at the quarterback. So, yeah, I agree and share your concern with both him seeing ghosts in general, but also just the amount of pounding and guys that are really able to line him up and unload on him. That's not a small quarterback, but that's not a big kid who can absorb a whole lot of those either.
No, exactly. Now, it would be better if defenses had to kind of fear his legs and they couldn't just come after him as a sitting duck, but this is the proest of pro-style offenses, so.
Do a lot of good for your offensive line, too, but
that's absolutely. Another discussion. Now, the one thing that's tough to tell, unless you're actually in the meeting rooms, is how often Francois is making the correct checks at line of scrimmage and what sort of freedom he has to make those checks. I would like to see Florida State do a little more college-type stuff and a little less pros-type stuff with a freshman quarterback, and that is some of the check-with-me, check-from-the-sidelines-type stuff, you know?
Well, if you're going to slow it down, then use the benefits of slowing it down.
Right, exactly.
That would make sense.
Because I would try to remove that responsibility from him. Make those calls from the sideline for him. That doesn't help him develop as a player. But Jimbo Fisher doesn't work for the NFL. He works for Florida State. His job is to win games at Florida State. The NFL success is it's a great byproduct, and it's a great recruiting tool, but it can't be the number one concern. I know Kentucky fans complain about this with John Calipari as well, although I'm not sure how much Calipari develops his kids for the NBA, considering most of them are there only a year. I think I'm pretty pleased with DeAndre Francois at this point, though. There's not a whole lot to be displeased with relative to him being a redshirt freshman. Others around him have got to play better. Jimbo Fisher has got to help him out with play calling, too, and in order to help them do better on first down so they stay out of some of those long down and distance situations.
tough kid and made a couple plays, but absorbed a couple hits, particularly the one he took on the first drive, where I have no idea how he maintained possession of the ball. There's certain aspects of him that you certainly have to admire, and on the whole, you still really like the product that you have and the product that you project a couple years down the line. But I don't think you're being overly concerned if you have some real fears and real concerns about what Florida State can do to project him and put him in a place to play as well as possible in his first year. You talked about quarterback development and how asinine it may be that Fisher has concerns for how he projects at the pro game. Look, you still got this guy for 3 or 4 years. Just get him through this period of his career, install confidence, and you can, there's a ton of things that you can put in over time with him. If you lose him this first in this first half of his first season, then you can throw all that stuff out the window. You've got to get him, you've got to keep him healthy, you've got to keep him on his feet, and you've got to put him in the best place possible for him to succeed.
Exactly. And one thing that would help him succeed, Ingram, I think it's time to have the Dalvin Cook conversation.
It's time. It certainly is. In my opinion, there's two things, but really I think there's three things, three possible options here. It's not that any of them are particularly good, would kind of pair with what you've seen from him so far. So Dalvin, in my opinion, is either injured and he are not disclosing it. He's either healthy and is playing with an eye towards Sunday, or he's healthy, but he doesn't trust that he's healthy. He doesn't trust what we both speculate is a shoulder that he lacks confidence in, and he's either he's one of the three. He's either injured with the shoulder, he's either healthy but is somehow trying to protect himself, or he's healthy and the doctors tell him he's healthy, but he doesn't have that same trust, and to an extent maybe playing a little bit scared as to whether or not his shoulder will hold up.
I think those are the only three options, and you just did a good job breaking that down. Do you have an opinion on which one it is?
I think he's injured. I do. Part of me wants to think that he's healthy, but he's scared. Because that gives you the best upside. That gives you a guy who maybe in the next couple games gets more confidence. But I haven't seen it. There's short little flashes. There's the bounce cut that he makes down at the sideline in this game. There was a quick little display of some of the quick feet that you remember from Dalvin in the Ole Miss game in a pass that he caught downfield. But you just don't see a guy who really looks like he's the Dalvin Cook of 2014 or 2015. So I'm confused. Part of me thinks that even if he is injured, like Dalvin Cook was injured all of last year, he wasn't pensive. He didn't run with any type of the manner that you could think that he was having an eye towards a period of time in which he would be collecting paychecks. Honestly, I don't know that I could really blame him if that was the case. But in my opinion, he's injured and he's concerned about re-injuring his shoulder to a greater extent. What is yours, Bud?
I think I agree with you.
I don't mean to interrupt you. This is interesting because I've heard three different opinions from three different from multiple people whose opinions I value. And part of the conundrum here is it's really not easy to identify at all.
Now, do I think Florida State is running him out there with risk of further injury? Not really, no. I think Jimbo Fisher cares deeply about Dalvin Cook. I mean, he's extremely defensive about Dalvin Cook, almost to the point of absurdity. Today, when he insisted that Dalvin Cook was fine and there was nothing wrong with Dalvin, I know several people threw out the old Iraqi information minister on Twitter.
Yes, Baghdad Bob.
Yes, Baghdad Bob, there we go. I think he's injured. Now, we've had people tweeting at us from the game on Saturday and said, hey, did you watch Dalvin in warmups when they do the one-handed catches on the sidelines? his right, like the one-handed thing with his right, which is his surgically repaired shoulder, was pretty useless, which I thought was really interesting. Like, he couldn't extend on it, they were saying. He does look like he's actively trying to avoid contact with his right shoulder, and some of the confrontations, the collisions that he has, are actually kind of awkward and clumsy looking now because he's trying to contort his body, it looks like, in my opinion, to not get hit on that shoulder. Does that mean it's actually hurt? Does that mean it's a pain tolerance thing? Does that mean that he's worried about re-injuring it? I don't know, but I 100% believe that his shoulder is affecting his running this year. He does not look like the Dalvin Cook of 2015, does not look like he's aggressively attacking the line of scrimmage, does not look like he's running with reckless abandon. He doesn't look anything like Dalvin Cook of 2015. So I'm going to throw you a curveball here, Ingram. If in the preseason we knew that Dalvin Cook was going to be a shell of his former self, which I believe he is, at least so far this year, what would your predicted record have been for Florida State? Oh, and if I had also told you that Derwin James would miss 2 months.
Yeah, Derwin, yeah, that's a game changer. It would, those two situations would have to add at least a loss apiece for me. I think I was had Florida State taking one loss during the regular season, that probably would have been more like three.
Same.
And not reaching the ACC championship game as I otherwise thought they would have. It's probably, you're better at this than I am as far as assigning particular value to players, whether it be point spreads or win totals. And it may be a gross overstatement to associate a win with either of those players, but that's the impact that they have on both units. You can't sit here and tell me that that Florida State's a legitimate playoff contender without having one of the more dominant running backs in the country and without having the player that may be the best safety in the country. Those are just two monumental pieces to take away from the puzzle.
Exactly right. Florida State's two biggest stars, with all due respect to DeMarcus Walker, who's a really good college player, but the two guys with amazing next-level talent are either not playing or not playing like it. That's a huge deal. Independent of all these blown assignments on defense and the struggles at offensive line and quarterback and receiver, I would absolutely have gone 9-3 had I known Dalvin was going to look like this and had I known Derwin James would miss 2 months, which is what I think he's going to miss. I would not have picked him to win the ACC. And so that's what I'm adjusting my prediction to. I think they're going to lose twice more in this season. Probably go 9-3, assuming they get some of the stuff fixed there in the back seven of the defense and don't have more crazy injury luck. They lucked out on the Josh Sweat thing, which is interesting that Jimbo Fisher didn't mention that in their official injury report, despite the fact that it's pretty obvious when, you know, one of your most high-profile players goes down in practice. So that definitely changes things on the season. But if they can, the one thing they can't do, they're not going to get Derwin back well before his timeline. There's some chance that Dalvin changes this around, if it's one of the couple options. Now, if he's actually injured, maybe not. But there may come a point to where he finds a way to trust the shoulder if it's actually structurally healthy and he could potentially run hard. If it's the third option, that he's essentially dogging it and try to protect himself and his NFL stock, that's certainly something he could remedy by giving more effort. But the thing is, we just don't know.
I really don't think it's that. And like I said, somewhat clumsily, I've had people whose opinion I value tell me that. I don't think you see a kid – look, he had a pretty nice NFL value last year. I don't think you see a kid getting his hammy rubbed out in the Miami game and returning four plays later when it looks like he's otherwise maybe out for months at a time. I just don't see a kid who had that level – of buy-in and that level of putting himself in front of the team have a 180 in mentality. I personally don't think that's occurred.
I agree with you. I believe that is the least likely option. Look, personally, would I do it? Maybe. I think that it's very unfair that running backs the caliber of Dalvin have to stay in school for 3 years and give up three of the most profitable years of their life instead of being able to play in the NFL. But if we go down that road too hard, this is going to be a 2-hour podcast, and we're not doing that tonight. His pass protection Saturday was terrible. I mean, just whiff on whiff on whiff. I do believe they need to. I'm sorry?
They got worse as the game went on. He was okay in the first quarter, and then he just started swinging and missing absolutely in plays where not only was he did he not execute well, you could kind of look at it and be like, yeah, that's poor execution. That's really lackluster effort as well. So
yeah, lazy, dogging it, fucking effort, which is shocking because I've never ever thought of Dalvin as a lazy player, and I don't think he's a lazy player. Which leads me to believe that something's going on with his shoulder. I think other media are starting to echo this, by the way. I heard Ira Shaffel, who works for War Chant, on the Jeff Cameron show today, and he said that it was his belief that he was also injured. So you're starting to have a lot of the media really doubt what Jimbo Fisher says about Dalvin Cook's lack of an injury.
So before we leave the subject, let's do talk about this real quickly, bud. If he is injured, and both parties keep denying that, that's really about the worst thing you could possibly do for Dalvin, both from an NFL perspective, but also just if this is his final year at tape, you're doing him an exceptional injustice to keep putting him out there and have this be film that he's going to be judged on. So I believe you when you say that that Fisher cares for Cook. I really do, and I don't doubt that. But like, there has to be some kind of clearing of the air here, or some type of resolution to the situation, because it's really the worst possible situation for all parties involved. And if you're going to have a running back the talent of Dalvin Cook, be bettered by Jacques Patrick on the day, then that's a situation that has to be addressed in one way or another.
And with all due respect to Jacques Patrick, who has clearly put in some work to get in better shape and is running harder, if he's Florida State's best back, that's not a good thing. But you do need to – I think you need to see an increased workload for Jacques Patrick here because Cook is not effective. And Fisher was very defensive of him again in the post game, and he said, well, we didn't block. That was true on some runs, but they certainly opened up some more holes for Patrick, who doesn't have near the speed that Cook has, than they did for Cook. So I do feel for Cook because the blocking across the board, the offensive line, the tight ends, the receivers, they really, really just kind of mailed it in. That was pretty pathetic.
Why don't we go ahead and move to kind of the final topic of the evening, and that is the play of the offensive line. Actually, we may have a couple other things we want to touch on, but play of the offensive line, bud, no different than the rest of the team. A really poor effort and a unit that you had a pretty reasonable expectations to perform at a high level. It really went out and got embarrassed and. Of all the units that we've talked about, this may be the one where you see a change in personnel the quickest.
Yes. As I understand it, there may have been some disagreement within the staff as to who certain coaches wanted to play. I'm not going to get into that too much. However, I think what you can look for, from what I understand, is they might give Brock Rubel a shot at that right tackle spot. I can report that Rubel took first-team reps at right tackle for at least a decent bit of Monday's practice. Jimbo Fisher also hinted at that Rubel would play more both on his coach's show and in Monday's press conference. He also said that they would look to do more rotating at guard. I thought Dickerson, the 17-year-old freshman, had some really nice moments, but they're also getting Cole Minshew back. Now that he's past the concussion stuff, hopefully, knock on wood here, the next step for him will be to get in better shape so they can actually go through a whole practice at a high level and be able to play in a game. Minshew is obviously really talented. If they can ever keep him healthy and in shape for maybe like a month, that would be an improvement. But yeah, I think they're going to start playing more bodies in the offensive line. Clearly, I think not having Derek Kelly – can we agree at this point, now that Kelly's knee is giving him trouble again, that moving Derek Kelly to guard was not a choice but rather a necessity due to him not recovering the same ability and quickness that he had pre-knee injury? I think to me that's very clear at this point.
Yeah, I don't think there's a whole lot of debate about that. And that's I feel bad for that kid because he's not the player, at least right now, that he was as a freshman even.
So the offensive line, I think it boils down to several different factors. The main one seems to be a lack of communication at times, right? Turning guys loose, not getting physically dominated, but I'll talk about that in a second. That has got to get fixed. That's on coaching, right? Not communicating, not making the right calls, not reacting with composure when Louisville shows different fronts that maybe you didn't expect, which I think they did some, and that's good coaching by Louisville to come out and do something that Florida State didn't expect. That's legal. If Florida State's coaching staff wanted to do that, they can certainly do that, and they do at times. That's sarcasm on my part. Of course they do. The biggest thing, I think, is the lack of communication there. The second biggest thing is you have a real inexperienced right side, which causes problems. Teams want to throw some exotic blitzes at that, as they should, and those exotic blitzes are going to get home, particularly when you don't really have very much assistance from your running back in terms of blitz pickup, and sometimes your tight end is not helping you out and chipping at all, because it really exposes a guy like a Dickerson and a Rick Leonard, and I guess we'll see if it'll expose Rubel on the right side. So teams know to attack over there. There's not a whole lot you can do about that. What you can do, though, and I really think this is something that Jimbo Fisher needs to do, you need to call a little bit different ball game. And I'm not, Ingram, you know me, I'm not a big play calling guy, right? I'm not, hey, call this play, call that play, because everybody always goes to play calling. Mm-hmm. But in talking with some guys who coach ball, who work for us, and who have played ball at a college level, they said, look, Florida State is asking some really tough things of its offensive line, and they've been doing it repeatedly now. Like, they did it against Ole Miss, and now they're doing it against Louisville. This seems like it's poor scouting, right? It's almost, we would yell at the defensive coordinator if he put some really slow cornerback out there in single coverage against an opponent's fast receiver, right? Because that's an obvious mismatch. Some of these blocks they're asking the offensive line to make, and we're not going to get super technical on this podcast about offensive line scheme, but the angles that they're asking them to block at are not real advantageous, and what they're doing is they're taking offensive linemen who, some of them are good players, some of them are not, and they're making them almost all look universally worse. Mm-hmm. Some of this is probably on checks not being made correctly with a freshman quarterback, but other times, it does seem like their run game does not have enough diversity right now, and they need to run more toss, they need to run more power and more counter, so that when teams are trying to slant and mess with some of your zone blocking and trying to flood your edges, you can hit them for that. Florida State did a couple times in this game and did it really successfully. They need to do that more. It's kind of like if you have... Florida State's offense right now is a bit like a pitcher who's just relying on his fastball way too much. And the fastball isn't 99. It's like sitting 94. And everybody in the big leagues can throw 94. You know?
More importantly, everybody can hit 94.
Excuse me. Yes. Right. So, especially when you have Dalvin Cook back there who doesn't look like himself. They have got to be a little bit more diverse in their run schemes to give this offensive line a better chance, man. This is not advantageous for the offensive line, in addition to the fact that it's playing poorly. Like, lack of effort, lack of communication. I think they're getting out toughed at times as well. I think Rick Leonard just physically got beaten several times in this game. I think everybody had at least probably one chance or one time they were beaten. I thought Rod Johnson played pretty well. That group right there has got to play better and in a hurry, and they should. Rick Trickett has a very good reputation within the industry. Obviously, fans always hate their offensive line coach. But this step forward from the offensive line is, I think, more theoretical than anything. They've really not been playing that much better than they were last year, and that's not acceptable because they were expected to make a big-time jump this year given all the depth they added and given the fact they brought everybody back. So far, it's one of the more disappointed groups on the team.
Yeah, it absolutely is, and not to be too Debbie Downer, but mark me as one that's skeptical as to how much better it gets with the addition of Brock Rubel. But honestly, your level of play at right tackle right now is not acceptable. A change probably needs to be made. So I'd be interested to see what the addition of the Rubel kid really does to what that group looks like. But you're right, have a lot of inexperience and a lot of questions along that right side of the line right now. And you really will, as long as you're pairing it with either Dickerson or Rubel or Dickerson or Leonard.
So I think that's probably it for the offensive line. This team is not going to be a great team with the offensive line playing like it is right now. I think that the fan base probably realizes the offensive line is not playing very well. Judging by my inbox, one guy sent me 8 emails, Ingram, over the weekend about the offensive line. And I reported,
because the first 7 just didn't convey it.
Ultimately, I reported him for spam. So, yeah, don't do that. Come on. Like, you know, trying to spend the day with my wife, and you're just like blasting me with emails about the offensive line, like I coach it or something. Anyway, Jimbo Fisher said that they didn't block. And I think a lot of people took that to mean the offensive line didn't block, which is true. But that's not the only part that didn't block. And going through the film review with our guys at Tomahawk, you know what we noticed, man? The receivers probably blocked just as bad as the offensive line did. Good God, this was a terrible effort. I mean, awful.
Blown assignments in the blocking game. Yeah, I mean, it was systematic problems, really, with every unit. And the receivers did nothing to make themselves any less guilty of what happened on Saturday.
All right, just going through our film review here, just from the first quarter, right? The first second down of the game that Florida State has, or excuse me, the second. Anyway, on the first drive of the game, Izzo actually gets beat by the defensive end. Not an offensive lineman. Izzo gets beat, and as Eberle is trying to pull, he gets knocked because Izzo gets beat by the defensive end. Now, if you're a casual observer, who are you putting that on?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, probably the offensive line.
Right.
That's not Eberle's fault. He's not expecting somebody to come hit him from the side because the tight end screwed up his block. This is what I'm saying. Yes, we can all agree the offensive line is a problem. It is not the entirety of the problem. On the very next play, that tunnel screen they try to throw to Dalvin Cook, you know what happens?
I know exactly where you're going. Yeah, 2 guys, 1 man.
Yeah, exactly. I mean,
pretty. I'm not a huge play call guy either, but that in general was a dicey situational call, in my opinion. But yeah, if it works, great. If not, you can always second guess it.
I 100% can agree. I mean, there are times where I think the receivers, due to the size mismatch with some of the safeties, needed to cut block instead of trying to stock block. That didn't work very well. There are a number of major mental errors by the receivers that you can't necessarily see when you're watching it live, and you need to go back and watch. That was terrible by them, and that shouldn't get overlooked either, especially, you know, Dalvin Cook likes to cut the ball to the outside a lot. You know what? It's hard to do to cut the ball to the outside if the receivers are blocking like crap. That's not good either. And so my question is, and I've raised this before, and after watching Alabama and Ohio State just kind of throw the ball up to talented players when they're not necessarily that open, Jimbo Fisher's offense is very much about plays and not players. I do think sometimes he needs to focus more on players, getting the ball into the hands of superior athletes. Ultimately, at receiver, the guys who play are the guys who understand his system, which is very tough on receivers because they have to make a lot of adjustments based on coverage that other offenses may not have to make. This is tough on some of the younger guys who are definitely superior athletes. It's the reason why a player like a Bobo Wilson plays more than, say, Auden Tate or more than Keith Gavin, because they don't, quote-unquote, know the offense as much. But guess what? Bobo Wilson's tiny. He's not going to be a great blocker for you on the edge. He's not a dynamic athlete. He's really not a great player. Does the rigidness of Jimbo Fisher's system in having to know the offense to such a mastery extent, to having such a mastery of the offense, does that keep more talented players on the bench? I would argue that at times it does. I would argue that at times Florida State needs to consider hey, if this player has one-on-one offense, or excuse me, has one-on-one coverage, he needs to be considered open. Ohio State does it. Alabama does it. They also run their quarterbacks a lot now. It seems to be working pretty well. Florida State very much dictates that the ball goes to the guy who is the open man, which is great if you got a quarterback who can process that quickly and you have guys who are getting open. But a lot of times in that game, they weren't getting all that open, and you had a quarterback who processed a lot more slowly than you would like. He was late on a lot of his reads, and he didn't anticipate the throws very well. But what a luxury it would be if you actually played Keith Gavin and Auden Tate more, two big guys who you think can go up and physically make a catch. Tate showed it a couple times there on Saturday, kind of later in the ballgame. I'm not saying run a jump ball offense here. Don't get me wrong. But if you have the one-on-one matchup, give them a chance. See what happens. It's better than what they're doing now a lot in the pass game, and it at least creates some threat. Also, those guys are really big, so in theory, they should be able to block decently on the edge with their length.
Man, a tough look back, not a podcast that we were short on topics, but not something that was necessarily fun to do, but good to look back and just give an opinion of really a historically poor effort, effort that would open up greater questions to be asked later on in the year if we see any kind of thing that is similar. It certainly puts the USF game into a light that we wouldn't have expected a couple of weeks ago. Just a kind of a game-changing effort for the negative, a result that makes you question everything that you had in mind as far as what this team could do coming into the season, and really, at least potentially, really makes you question the trajectory of the season and where this team will go. So a lot to look for, a lot to talk about. I don't think we'll touch on this game a whole lot more, but we'll maybe look back and discuss further in the week as far as what it means for the season going forward. So anything else that you wanted to comment on as far as a historic 43-point loss on Saturday?
I mean, I feel like we've done an hour on it. I'm interested to see just how much this coaching staff can improve this team 1 week, because this betting line is five points. This is a very losable game for Florida State. I know we're going to preview it later in the week. If they lose this game, this team could do more than just quit in a game. It could quit on Jimbo Fisher for the season. And then you got real problems and real questions wondering whether you can get your team back. This is a game you really cannot afford to lose. If you lose this, going into North Carolina, Miami games coming up, with Clemson down the line a little bit, you're in trouble. You've got to win this ball game. You've got to figure out a way to instill confidence in these players, but still not have them be cocky. You need to be confident, but with discipline. That's a fine line they're going to have to walk. I think it starts with running your quarterback more to put your offensive line into better situations, creating the extra gap on offense. You've got to do that. You've got to play more of a college offense. And then on defense, I think you have to simplify some of your coverage principles, try and run less packages, get the call in quicker, just get lined up, and hope that your superior athleticism can make a difference.
Bud, one final piece of information before we leave this podcast, unrelated to the effort on Saturday, but it does appear as though Florida State will have a person joining them in practice as far as the quarterback position goes.
Yes, we reported tonight on Tomahawk Nation that Malik Henry has returned to practice. He was suspended on August 20th. Today is September 19th. That is almost a month to the day. Ingram, do you think this suspension length was planned by Fisher, or do you not know, or do you think it just happened to come back? Now, we're not reporting that the suspension is lifted as far as games or anything. Not that I think he would play in a game anyway. I think he's a long way from doing that. But at least he's back at practice, where he hasn't been in about a month.
I don't really know the details, to be honest with you, and I won't feign that I do. I will say that I think you need to either have Malik Henry back, be part of the team, be convinced that he's willing to do things to be part of the team, or just cut him loose. And that may sound cold. That may not be what you would want to do with a kid, particularly a kid that talented. But I think with Henry, you've either got to have him buy in, or he would be better off occupying a roster spot somewhere else.
I 100% agree, and I'm glad he's back. I really hope the kid can make something of his career and stay on the right path. So, you got anything else tonight?
No, man, that was a good conversation. Hopefully people enjoyed it. Not fun, probably not a whole lot of fun to listen to. Hopefully it was informative. We tried to be as honest as possible, not have crazy irresponsibly hot takes, I guess I would say, but also have a real honest assessment as to what this team is, the performance that you saw from the team on Saturday. And yeah, if you see another loss, particularly a loss this weekend, then we'll have a whole different conversation and a more macro conversation as far as the culture of the program, buy-in of players, etc. But for now, I think it's best to just look at what you saw on Saturday, particularly what you might see as far as a response and how you try to remedy some of the easier problems to fix. But it was an ugly game. Only gets uglier when you watch it on tape, in my opinion. And hopefully we did as good a job as possible as representing what we saw and what we think it might look like moving forward.
Yeah, man, I agree. If they go out there and screw around and lose to USF, we go from talking about one of the worst losses in program history to one of the most disappointing seasons in program history. Because if that happens, there's a good chance they could lose 5 ball games. That's not a year of podcasting I'm really looking forward to doing, but I know the numbers would be absolutely huge. Y'all loved the instant reaction podcast that we did, apparently. That was the most listens we've ever done in a 24-hour period for a non-National Signing Day podcast.
Hopefully this Saturday is just a nice, easy number on the numbers. I'll put it that way.
Yes, I agree. Ingram, we would appreciate, though, if you guys enjoy this podcast, please rate and review us on iTunes and share us on Facebook or whatever social media platform that you use. We always appreciate that. We're the number one Florida State podcast because of your support, and we hope to continue that because of your support.
Smile, though your heart is aching. Smile, even though it's breaking. When there are clouds in the sky, you'll get by if you smile through your fear and sorrow. Smile and maybe tomorrow you'll see the sun come shining through for you. Light up your face with gladness. Hide every trace of sadness. Although a tear